Welcome to Leonard Lopate Weekend, where we bring you three of our favorite segments from the last week in case you missed them. You can find all of our segments on the WNYC app, our website at WNYC.org, or on iTunes. Just search for Leonard Lopate. And of course, you can also listen to us live on the radio every weekday starting at noon. Is it possible for any but the most famous authors to make a living doing what they love? Are there writers who do nothing but write fiction or poetry all day? To help aspiring writers better understand what to expect, Mandela Martin has edited a new collection of essays from Simon & Schuster called Scratch, Writers, Money, and the Art of Making a Living. Mandela Martin, the founder of Who Pays Writers and Scratch Magazine, joins us now, along with two of her book's contributors, Leslie Jameson, author of the award-winning essay collection, Empathy Exams. Her work has appeared in Harper's, Oxford American, among other publications. And also here is Alexander Chi, author of the award-winning novels, Edinburgh and The Queen of the Night. He is a contributing editor to The New Republic. I'm very pleased to welcome these distinguished writers to our show now. Welcome.
It's great to be here.
Thank you.
Mandela, considering that this is a book that deals with the difficulty that writers often have getting paid for their work, I'm just slightly uneasy asking this question. Did you pay all of the contributors?
I did, and that was very important to me. I did pay contributors. People who wrote new essays for the book got a bit more. People who whose work I reprinted or who had reworked their work.
And you interviewed some.
And some were interviews. Those people did not get paid, as journalistic ethics dictate.
You founded a magazine called Scratch and gave that name to this collection. What does that word mean when it's used in reference to writers earning money?
Well, it's slang for money. You would say, like, oh, got to get some scratch together. And then it also has a sort of scrappiness about it that I think is really suited to what it's like to be a writer, sort of putting together a living out of all the various things we do.
And of course, when writers wrote with pens, they were scratching on the paper.
Yes. Chicken scratch.
Chicken scratch.
Leslie, are writers often asked to work for free?
Yeah, I think all the time. I mean, I certainly have worked for free. I think it's a different calculus each time. My agent would kill me for confessing that publicly.
Well,
that
is there
I work
some
for
etiquette,
free.
Etiquette as to when you say yes and when you turn something down?
Well, for me personally, there are a couple different reasons that I might do a project, and if I'm committed to writing the piece or feel really passionate about writing something, then I'll just write it and figure out afterwards whether I can get paid for it. And sometimes, especially in the past, the best home for a piece might be somewhere where it wasn't getting paid. But I do think, and my experience of being a writer, you know, when you were talking about, oh, is there the writer out there who writes poems all day? You know, every single writer I know, their days are some kind of jigsaw puzzle of the labor that pays the rent and the labor of the heart.
They teach or they work for a publication or edit or do something else.
Absolutely. I mean, in my 20s, my jobs were more service industry based. So I was like a barista. I worked at a bakery. I worked as an innkeeper at a B&B. I worked as a tutor. I think there are also a lot of people who are doing more like teaching, editing, that kind of freelance.
And I remember some writer said when he was asked about being a copywriter that you can't be a prostitute during the day and a virgin at night. But
as a former copywriter, I disagree.
Alexander, you write that in submitting articles, you were paid as much as $3 per word and as little as nothing. Why is there such an asymmetry?
capitalism. I mean, I think that, like a lot of us, I probably make my living out of, I try to do a mix of things for free and things for as much as possible, as much money for as little work, I suppose, is the calculus there.
Well, does it depend on the venue?
Oh,
would you work for free if you knew you were going to have a bigger audience? Because I would assume it's more likely that you're going to be asked to work for free for a smaller publication.
Oh, no, not at all. You'd be surprised at the big places that would ask you to write for free. I think, you know, I developed a system early on where if someone said that writing for free for them was going to guarantee me a big audience, I would go to Alexa and check their web traffic rankings. And then I would make my decision about whether they actually had the traffic to back up that kind of claim. But I think, you know, the thing with these things that we write is that, you know, yes, on the one hand, we do this work of the heart, as Leslie said, but also we only have so much life to give to this work. And the more that we are paid, the more we are able to work. So it's really, for writers, money is time. Mm-hmm. And these, it's like, especially if I'm writing essays about my own experiences in particular, you only get a few takes on that before you don't really have the ability to write about it anymore, probably, not with any credibility. And so you want to make sure that that you don't sell your life for cheap, either in terms of hours spent on the work or the experiences that you're describing.
I'm speaking with Alexander Chi and Leslie Jameson, two of the contributors, along with Jonathan Franzen, Cheryl Strayed, Jennifer Weiner, Roxanne Gay, Yi-Yun Lee, Suzanne Orlean, to a new book that was edited by Manjula Martin, the founder of Scratch magazine, called Scratch, The Writer's Money and the Art of Making a Living. It is published by, who's publishing this? Oh, Simon Schuster. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Well, you write, Alexander, in your essay called Wizard, about how interesting you found the correspondence between Gustave Flaubert and George Sand, especially when they wrote about money. And I invite everybody else to join in on this conversation. Do writers talk a lot about the money aspect of the work?
Well, they... You know, it's funny. I mean, so I'd always been told that this correspondence was like the most brilliant literary correspondence that ever existed. And when I actually turned to it, I found that it was almost entirely about money. How much did you get paid for this? Do you have money for this? How much do you think I could get for this? And so on. And, you know, it was interesting because they had very uneven social class positions, and they were having a friendship across those positions. And Flaubert had a great deal more security than she did, than Sand did, even though Sand was also just, you know, by any stretch of the imagination, an absolute champion at getting her work finished and paid for. I think, you know, now writers, I hear a lot from people when I talk about money with them. I hear a lot of people say to me, oh, you know, people don't really talk about that. I'm really glad that you talk about that. And I find that a little surprising, and I wonder if it's I always wonder if I'm breaking some sort of, you know, code that I'm not supposed to be talking about it. But I honestly don't think it's a bad thing to talk about it.
And well,
I think
Leslie, you are nodding your head.
No, I was just going to say I'm glad you're breaking the code, Alex, because I mean I wish people talked about money more because I think it can be incredibly lonely making or alienating to both be wrestling with these issues that every single one of us is wrestling with, but also to feel like it's the kind of shameful part of the profession, that you're thinking about it as much as you are, devoting as much time to it as you are. And I think that there's something, just a liberating authenticity about just getting honest about the fact that it's part of the creative life.
And why is it considered taboo?
I think part of it maybe comes back to that the having a friendship across social positions dynamic that Alex was alluding to between Flaubert and Sand, that it can be uncomfortable to speak to somebody when they don't know your position, you don't know their position, this idea of inequality. But I actually think that it just deepens whatever the divides of inequality and kind of sustains them to make it something that always has to be kept in the margins of silence.
And Manjula, yeah. In almost all of your interviews, you ask the writers about their social class, whether they've changed it and which class they identify with.
I do, yeah. I think the class component is a huge one in writers. And Susan Orlean in our interview talks really smartly about that, where she talks about how even though she makes a lot more money than perhaps some other writers, like, she considers herself to be like a part of the artistic class. And I think there is a lot of truth to that. But I also think that one of the things we talk about when we talk about money and literature, I would extend this to most of the arts also, is access. Like, if only there's a lot of privilege in the literary world, there are a lot of the chain to sort of having access to the industry involves things like unpaid internships and writing for free, as we've all done and will probably continue to do sometimes, using our own rules for that. And if you're not a person who has the luxury of writing for free or sort of treating discussions about money as though they're déclassé, then you don't have access to this business. And that directly affects the types of stories that are getting told.
Wasn't it assumed for a while that most writers already had some money? Proust didn't have to work for a living. He just could have, you know, he was a gentleman writer. And we have a lot of writers throughout the history of literature who started off rather comfortably.
Yeah. there are a lot of gentlemen writers, and there continue to be. I think in the book there's an essay by Colin Dickey, a nonfiction author, where he goes into the history of the first Greek poet to ask to be paid by the word.
Simonides.
Yeah, and how everyone thought he was really not classy and very greedy for doing so. And I think that is, you know, so there's a longstanding history of sort of this idea that money taints the arts.
Poets are the easiest people to pay by the word, right? Wouldn't poets be the
depends on the poet?
What about you, Alexander? Are you asked to submit works of fiction for no pay?
You know, literary journals are a little. They're well known for not being able to pay you very much. You know, like $50, $100, $200, and maybe like a. A few contributors' copies, sometimes just contributors' copies. And in those cases, you know, like, the calculus with that is always, like, will this journal then, you know, is this journal helpful in terms of, say, your tenure file, if you're also, you know, employed somewhere and possibly going up for tenure? Or will they put your work up for other anthologies like the Pushcart Prize or Best American or whatnot? Like, if you're someone who, for example, can't really afford to work for free, but you are approached by a situation like this, if you can think through some of those aspects to it, then you can take a risk like that a little better than, say, someone else. But I think, you know, nonfiction is the thing that pays the most. Fiction, short stories, especially paid short stories. From magazines, that has been in decline at least since the 90s, when Tina Brown took over the New Yorker and cut back the number of stories that the New Yorker published, and also sort of promulgated a myth, which was that people didn't read short stories in magazines, which was, like, I know a lot of people who still, like, scream her name in the night over that one.
Angela, you also have people talking about finishing a novel, having spent years working on a novel, and now having no money to pay the rent because they haven't been able to do anything else. Or going on a book tour and being expected to pay for a hotel that they can't when their credit cards are maxed out.
Yeah, I put this book tour on my credit card, just in the interest of full transparency, which I should say is not necessarily a slight on my publisher. It's very common that publishers don't send authors on book tours nowadays, which is a thing that has changed somewhat. I think it's a really hard thing. It takes a lot of time to do what we do, and figuring out how to, you know, surface that work while also paying the rent is the big question, I think, for most creative people.
Well, I think that's one of the many things that is productive about just bringing these conversations into the open, is that there's nothing that's been more helpful to me in figuring out how to support myself as a writer than just hearing other writers' accounts of how they made it possible, which are infinitely more helpful when they actually get into the nuts and bolts and really affect the kind of work that gets paid. Like Alex was talking about how different genres get paid in different ways, which is absolutely right. I also think about you know, reading a quote from Gates Elise, like lamenting how young writers are constantly writing about themselves rather than writing journalism. But the truth is like journalism costs a lot more for a young writer who's not on staff at a magazine, isn't getting funded, you know, for pitches. Like, it's actually kind of, in a certain way, it's more economical to write about personal experience than to pay to fly yourself to Europe to report some piece, you know? So those kinds of the shifting economic terms are part of figuring out how, understanding those terms is part of figuring out how to produce the kind of work you want to make.
I have to take a little break here, but we will return to Leslie Jamison, author of the award-winning essay collection Empathy Exams. She also writes for Harper's, Oxford American, and other publications. Alexander Chi, his award-winning novels are Edinburgh and The Queen of the Night, and he's a contributing editor to The New Republic. And the book that we are discussing was edited by Manjula Martin, who's the founder of Who Pays Writers and Scratch Magazine, and it's called Scratch, Writers, Money, and the Art of Making a Living. It's published by Simon & Schuster. Stay with us for more. And we're back with a bunch of writers. Manjula Martin, who's edited a new collection of essays from Simon & Schuster called Scratch, Writers, Money, and the Art of Making a Living, which has some very impressive contributors, two of whom are with us, Leslie Jamison and Alexander Chi. And I think most people assume that one of the ways that you that writers are helped is that they get an advance when, well, first, let's even back up a bit. Can you even get a book published if you don't have an agent?
It's been done. It's being done, yes.
But it's rare. A lot of publishers, they give the intern the slush pile, the books, the unsolicited manuscripts that come in, and it's unlikely that any of those books are going to be published.
Yeah, well, there's also a whole world of self-publishing, which I don't know very much about, to be honest.
And I think, I mean, as far as I know, with big New York houses, I think most everything that gets published comes through an agent, but there's also a really active and kind of remarkable world of indie publishers who are putting out some of the work that I'm most excited about. And I think some of those publishers, it would be more likely, I mean, most of their submissions would come through agents, but maybe a little bit more possible to get to them not through an agent.
But you say that in the case of advances, actually they don't come right away, so they can't really keep you going through the full time that you have to devote to writing a book.
They come in fits and starts. Usually when you get a book advance, it's broken up into several installments. So you'll get some of it, you know, anywhere from a quarter to half of it usually when you sign the contract. And then the other payments are dependent on you delivering the book and it being ready for publication, and then on the day of publication.
Alexander, was that your experience with your novels?
Well, I was going to say, if you have an agent, they can negotiate for you to get paid on completion, like on signing and then on completion, so that you're not waiting for a last check on publication day. So there are some advantages to having an agent. And I think that, you know, the sort of, you know, my first novel sold for $6,000, and my hardcover publisher was an indie publisher that went bankrupt before paying me the last $2,000 of it. My second novel, you know, was a more generous advance, and that advance didn't see me through the writing of the entire book, but it did make a lot of things possible, and I'm very grateful for that.
Cheryl Strayed talks about her advance in the book, where, you know, she viewed it as getting like a pretty good grant once a year for, in her case, it was 3 or 4 years for her first novel.
It's a big difference between fiction and nonfiction, too. Like, my first book was a novel, and with a novel, you really have to fund, at least for me, because I was not a known name at all, I had to fund the entire writing of the novel, because you can't sell a novel unless you're known until it's done. So you have to figure out a way to get it written. Whereas with certain kinds of nonfiction, it's much more possible to sell the book on proposal and have that first part of the advance funding your writing of it.
Manjula, didn't Nick Hornby tell you that the era of writers getting big advances and movie deals are over?
He did tell me that.
He said the door slammed behind him.
You know, that's something that I've definitely heard a lot from writers who have sort of reached a more successful peak in their career. I mean, I think people still get big advances. It happens, it hits the news every now and then. And Alexander talks about this in his essay. You know, it's not a new thing for the publishing world to be all a Twitter about $1 million advance for a first novel. But it's also not a particularly sustainable goal.
It's a thing that happens perennially, I think, that also there's like a series of articles that come out that suggest that suddenly writers are paying $1 million, you know. And if you Google, like, the $1 million novel, like I say in my essay, you can see a forest of these pieces show up going back to at least to the era of Donna Tartt.
But they're really part of the PR aspect of selling books, aren't they? Because it's almost impossible for me to have a first novelist on the show who received a huge advance without me saying, you got a huge advance. That's part of the story. You also say you had three professors who had university housing, good salaries, and time to write. Is that lifestyle disappearing?
That is another, you know, payments to writers have been under attack, and also academia. So as, you know, a kind of restructuring of academia has occurred in the last 30 years, you know, more and more you see adjuncts in departments and more administrators, for some reason, who have access to the funds that faculty used to have. And I'm not really sure. That's not really a sustainable model either. You know, it's the faculty who are working for such low pay are, you know, often driven into poor health. There was just an essay about this man who was selling his blood, who's an assistant professor somewhere.
Josh Roiland at the University of Maine,
And he was just trying to pay off his debt from being an adjunct.
And, Leslie, you teach at Columbia. Do you warn your students about these sorts of things?
Absolutely. I mean, the other thing, and Alex just got to it, I mean, one really important thing to say when you're talking about the Academy funding writers is there's just a huge difference between the way that labor is compensated for tenure track faculty and the way that labor is severely undercompensated for adjunct faculty. And it's a scandal of the Academy. And then another scandal of the Academy, which, I do talk to students about, is student debt and the way that, you know, MFA programs fund in very different ways. But there are a tremendous number of young writers who are in debt for a variety of reasons. And one of them is that some writers who are getting paid to teach in the Academy are getting funded essentially by the student debt of students who are paying to be part of it. So
you also say that there are two focal points, New York and Iowa.
No, I wouldn't MFA. Be caught saying that, but I was actually trying to kind of push back against this model that insists that there are sort of only two worlds. There's the New York world and the MFA or Academy world, and they're entirely separate. To me, what's interesting about talking about the New York writing world and the writing world of the Academy is actually that it's one way of accessing this question of who's funding writers today. And there is some funding coming from big New York publishing houses, big New York magazines, and there is some funding coming from various academic institutions. But as Manjula said earlier, and I think made a really important point, you know, there's a lot of people left out by those funding equations, and there's still like a pretty rarefied mode of access to the literary world. So,
and I think it's a sort of a false dichotomy. Yeah. Like, there's neither one nor the other. They're parts of the same world.
Susan Orlin told you that being a writer is like running your own business. Do you think that writers are prepared for that? Don't they see this as something very different? I'm an artist.
Yeah, I think I personally think that writers are not prepared by that. Are not prepared for that by the programs that they attend. I, even just on this book tour, talking to students at MFA programs and students even in undergrad programs who have no idea of the basic economics of this industry. And I think there's great value in sort of an MFA program where people can take time away from the commercial aspect of their business and really work on their craft. I'm not dissing that necessarily. But I also find it somewhat unconscionable that one can get a terminal degree in one's field without even having the slightest idea of how it functions.
There's a kind of nervous breakdown people have after they get their MFA that I think comes from not being prepared in any way for what they're going to do afterwards in terms of making a living.
Yeah.
Do you encourage your students to supplement their incomes with, say, copywriting for advertising agency?
I try to talk them through things, through a variety of things. Like, there's a lot of great jobs that you can have as a writer that, I had a friend who works. I have a friend who works as an assistant to a researcher who doesn't need her very often, and so she spends a lot of time in the office writing her books, and then also has insurance, and then every now and then he asks her to do something like FedEx a pillow that he needs.
Dream job.
I know. I think the problem is, in some ways, is that there's these narrow ranges of things that people think you can do, but there's so much you can do that doesn't like rob you of the will to write also, you know.
I mean, because I teach at a nonfiction writing program in New York City, and all of my students, it's not even a question of supplementing their income, it's a question of creating their income. And part of my actually like privilege as their teacher is I get to read about like the widest, wildest variety of jobs, and certainly have worked them as well.
But even successful writers, getting back to Nick Hornby, he says that he relies on speaking fees to supplement his income.
Mm-hmm. That's pretty common, actually, with writers who are fairly prominent. Austin Kleon, the writer of this book called Steal Like an Artist, who's also in Scratch, talks about how he's trying to increase... He wants his income to be primarily from speaking gigs, because apparently when at a certain level, those pay. At other levels, they don't pay, as we were talking about during the break.
Well, most politicians, after they get out of politics, they live off of speaking fees. So
yeah.
I guess unless you run for president, it's something that can't be used against you. Alexander, you say that one of your professors taught you to use the Best American Essays collections as a guide for submitting works. How is that helpful?
Yes, Annie Dillard suggested that. Her method was basically to look through the collection, figure out which publications were the ones who had essays that were included in the anthology, and then to look in the back at the notable essays and see which magazines had published those, and then, you know, addresses were included in the back, but always to double check because things change, as she said. But it was a very useful sort of strategy for thinking through how to begin sending out work, and it made it less terrifying. You know, when I was leaving her class as an undergraduate, I knew one writer who was a professional writer, and he was a newspaper columnist, and he wasn't writing anything like what I wanted to do. So I didn't, in terms of like people who would tell me what to do besides my teachers, there really wasn't anything in my environment that told me what to do. So it was always about, did I have the nerve to ask somebody what I didn't know? Mm-hmm. And that was always the thing that I had to push myself to do.
Leslie, should there be courses in colleges specifically about how to survive as a writer in the real world?
Well, this is one of the things that I was thinking about earlier in the conversation, is I certainly believe that it's a pretty important part, especially of graduate writing education, to give students access to forums where they can ask precisely those kinds of questions that Alex is talking about, asking about all the things they don't know without feeling shamed for asking them, without feeling like they're taking this like beautiful aesthetic conversation and polluting it by introducing the question of money into the room. So for me, part of what we try to do at Columbia is facilitate like panel discussions where those are explicitly the questions on the table, but also in some of the craft classes, not just talk about, well, how do you put a work of reportage together, but how do you write a pitch? How do you think mm-hmm. about how you might sell this piece? So introducing some of those pragmatic questions into the conversation.
What do you wish somebody had advised you about? I'm running out of time, so you have to make it quick.
I think that what Alex said about not being afraid to ask what you don't know is a pretty mm-hmm. beautiful and durable idea.
Did a lot of writers talk to you about this, Manjula?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The number one sort of response that I've had both from the contributors and the readers to this book has been, oh my God, I'm so glad that it's not just me who's asking these questions.
There's going to be a panel discussion tonight featuring Manjula Martin and fellow Scratch contributors, including Leslie Jameson. That's at 7 o'clock at Powerhouse Books in Brooklyn at 28 Adams Street. RSVPs are appreciated. You can find a link to it on our show page at wnyc.org/lopate. The book is called Scratch, and my great thanks to Alexander Chi, Leslie Jameson, and Manjula Martin for being on our show today.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
It's 2017, and women still make up only 19% of Congress, 25% of state legislators, and 8% of governors in the United States. But interestingly, Donald Trump's election has inspired more women of both parties to decide to run for office. Joining us to talk about this surge of women candidates are Andrea Dew Steele, president and founder of Emerge America, a group that provides training to aspiring female Democratic leaders in 17 states, and Debbie Walsh, director of the Center for American Women in Politics at the Eagleton Institute of Politics at Rutgers University. I'm pleased to welcome both of them to our show. Hello.
Hello. Thanks for having us.
We also want to hear from our listeners. If you're a woman who's interested in running for office or is currently involved in politics, you can give us a call at 212-433-9692. Debbie, can you tell us about Ready to Run?
Sure. Ready to Run is a nonpartisan campaign training program that we've been conducting here in New Jersey for about 15 years. It's been quite successful. New Jersey used to rank in the bottom 10 in the nation for the percentage of women serving in our state legislature, and we now rank 14th. So we've definitely moved up. We also have partner programs in about 14 states around the country. And I think what we are seeing this year, not just here in New Jersey, but all across the country, is a real surge in interest in participation. Our program here in New Jersey is March 10th and 11th, and we are bursting at the seams and looking for a larger space to hold our training. So this seems to be the story we're hearing around the country.
And you're saying that this increase is happening in blue states and red states?
We're seeing it in blue states and in red states and some states that are a little more purple. We are seeing it in our partners in Pennsylvania, in Oklahoma, in Iowa, in Ohio. It is around the country, and there is a real interest in having a voice in American politics that I think we haven't seen. You mentioned that women make up such a small percentage of elected officials. There's no level of office in this country where women make up more than a quarter of the elected officials. And after the last election, we saw no increase in the number of women serving in the U.S. Congress. So there's a real need for more women to be present. And I think the result of this last election really showed women around the country that elections have consequences and that they can no longer sit on the sidelines. They have to step up. And if they want to see different kind of governmental institutions, they need to be involved and they need to be those people that actually run for office.
Andrea, what about your organization, Emerge America? Have you seen an increase in applications?
Yes, we have. So at Emerge America, our mission is to increase the number of Democratic women leaders from diverse backgrounds in public office through recruitment, training, and providing a powerful network. We focus on early stage recruitment, and so we recruit 365 days a year in our 17 states. And then we do a training, an in-depth training of 6 months, And following that training, we provide these women with a network of support. So what we've seen since the election is an incredible increase in the number of women interested in running for office. So we were very fortunate because our application process directly follows the election. And we saw an 87% increase in our applications. And we also did some webinars for women who were interested in running for office, and we saw 1,500 women sign up for those webinars. So we're seeing an incredible increase, and I think it's mainly because women woke up and realized that we had elected the most misogynistic president in the history of this country. It was an incredible slap in the face to women all over America, particularly those who supported Hillary. And what we also heard from women is they didn't realize how much they wanted a woman president until she lost. And, you know, they also saw a woman in Hillary who was a superb candidate. She won three debates and had to go against a man who whispered nasty woman to her and all kinds of unbelievable behavior that he displayed. She was flawless. She was intelligent, certainly the smartest person in the room. And this, I think, really woke women up all over the country. And I am incredibly heartened by this. Because the biggest reason we don't have more women in office is because not enough women want to run.
Well,
so the fact that women woke up after this terrible election, from my perspective, and they decided to look into running for office is an incredibly hopeful sign for those of us who care about really utilizing the best talents that we have in this country, because that's why we need women running for office.
Well, Debbie, you're nonpartisan, but is there a sense that Trump's victory, despite his lack of political experience, has inspired women who also might not have political experience to run for office?
Well, I think we're exactly seeing women who don't have a lot of political experience thinking about now running for office. And I think we had a little bit of a concern after the last election that the result of Clinton's loss might be that women would retreat from politics, that they would look at that campaign and the tone and the tenor and say, that's not for me. Or think if a woman as qualified as Hillary Clinton can't get elected, what hope do I have? But in fact, we woke up the day after the election to find that registrations were already starting to pour in for our Ready to Run program in ways that we have never seen at that early date. And what we really saw was that women were reacting, I think in some ways, as Andrea says, you know, they were reacting by being inspired by Hillary Clinton's win, but also being angered by Donald Trump's win. I mean, Hillary Clinton's loss and Donald Trump's win. And that win by Donald Trump really woke women up to the fact that they need to step up and have a voice. I think you saw that in the march in Washington and the marches all around the country and the world, where women were saying, we want to have a voice in this new, as this new administration takes hold and policies are changing, and we want to make sure that we're not sitting on the sidelines powerless and voiceless.
But
and running for office is one of the most powerful ways that you can have a voice on the inside and at the table when decisions are being made.
But just a few years back in 2013, the American University School of Public Affairs issued a report which was headed, Girls Just Want to Not Run, and it revealed that among potential candidates, lawyers, business leaders, educators, and political activists, women are less likely than men to express interest in a political career. And I was looking back at the last time we talked about women running in 1992, the so-called Year of the Women, after Clarence Thomas was confirmed, we were hearing that women were going to run. What's happened?
Well, Well, you know, that year we did see that Year of the Woman. We've had a lot of them. They get called Year of the Woman frequently. We saw a doubling in the number of women in Congress that year as a result of a lot of things. One of the things that we saw was there were open seats, lots and lots of open seats. And so there were real opportunities for women. But we also had seen decades of women running for county office and state legislative office, and they were prepared to meet that opportunity when it came along. I think the work that you're referring to from American University is really talking in some senses, I think, about blaming women for the fact that they, in fact, don't get recruited in the same ways that men do to run for office. You know, women have great ambition to change the world. When we do surveys of men and women serving in state legislatures, the reason that they say they ran for office the very first time was because of a policy issue. When we ask the men who serve in state legislatures, they say, it's because they've had a long-standing interest in a career in politics. We think of that as women run to do something and men run to be somebody. But the reality is, I think for a lot of women, they look at governmental institutions, and if they want to make change, they may think Congress, for certainly looking at the gridlock there, is not the place to make change. And so what a lot of women do is they kind of work around government, and they end up in working for nonprofit organizations, foundations, and they try to do the work on the ground. And then there comes a moment when they realize that to really have that voice, they need to be inside those governmental institutions with a seat at the table. You know, there's a great saying that if you're not at the table, you're probably on the menu. And I think for a lot of women, that's what occurs to them. That's what happens in that moment when they make the decision to run for office.
I'm speaking with Andrea Drew Steele and Debbie Walsh. The topic is running for office, something that women have been reluctant to do in the past. In fact, the report that I cited said young women are less likely than young men to think they will be qualified to run for office even once they're established in their careers. We have some calls coming in. Kate Moyer from Philadelphia. Hi, you're on the air. Kate?
Go ahead.
Hi, Kate.
Hi.
Go ahead.
So I'm a member of the Emerge Pennsylvania program, and I reside in Harrisburg, which is the seat of government in the state of Pennsylvania. And I can attest to the impact that that Emerge's program has on women who were inspired by the election in November to finally take the leap to run for office. And I know for myself, it was an incredibly intimidating process. I was a political science major in college, communications and political science. I've always been really involved in politics. My father was a union steel worker, and my parents always really encouraged us to pay attention to what was happening in the political climate, to ask questions, to formulate our own belief systems, and also to challenge them, to become stronger in them. But becoming a part of the political system in America as a candidate was always something I thought I couldn't do, that I didn't go to law school, I wasn't from a wealthy family, and I wasn't a guy. So the odds were stacked against me. And this election and watching the results come in November, on November 8th, I didn't go to sleep that night. And I woke up the next day and I said, I have to do something about this, whether it's on a small scale in my own community or on a larger scale nationally. You know, hopefully someday that's something that could happen. But I needed to get involved. And the Emerge program was the gateway for me to jumpstart my involvement in the political world.
What do you want to accomplish if you're elected to the Harrisburg City Council?
Harrisburg is going through what I like to term a sociocultural renaissance right now. They have seen an incredible amount of growth in the arts and culture scene, and that has contributed to economic growth in the city as well. And that has been the result of a really concerted effort on the part of partnerships between city government and state government, and also local investors. And I would like to see us continue to improve the city, not just in certain neighborhoods where growth has been focused for the last few years, but to identify opportunities throughout the city of Harrisburg. I think it offers a really unique economic environment and also cultural climate for people. There's a really wonderful dichotomy of culture between this daytime politics, business-focused environment, and then those folks go home at night or leave the city, and the people that live there are really driven by wanting to have rich cultural experiences, have great restaurants and entertainment.
And
so
Kate,
I would love to find a way to partnership to continue that growth.
And I hear that you already have one of your speeches worked out. Thank you for participating in our show.
Thanks so much for having me.
We're going to take a little break. A lot of people are calling in, actually. It turns out there are a lot of women who are thinking of running for office, and we will get to them, and we will continue our conversation with Andrea DuSteele, president and founder of Emerge America, which is a group that provides training to aspiring female Democratic leaders in 17 states, and Debbie Walsh, director of the Center for American Women in Politics at the Eagleton Institute of Politics at Rutgers University, about to put together a conference in New Jersey on March 10th and 11th at Rutgers called Ready to Run. And we are back with our look at women running for office with Debbie Walsh of the Center for American Women in Politics at the Eagleton Institute of Politics at Rutgers University and Andrea DuSteele, president and founder of Emerge America, and taking your calls at 212-433-9692 if you're thinking of running for office or have thoughts about why more women have not considered running for office. Marjorie from the Bronx, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
We are well. Are you okay?
I am doing well, yeah, thank you. It's been an exciting time for me. I announced in November, so it's been quite a ride.
So you announced in November before or after the election results?
After. It definitely inspired me to be more involved. I mean, I already have been in my community. I've been elected treasurer for my community board, part of both Democratic clubs. And I also was the first Latina voted as district leader for my area. So I've had some experience in that race, but definitely want to take it a larger, bigger step in running for city council.
Well, good luck with your race.
Thank you. Thank you.
So far, we've been hearing from Democrats. What about you, Immaculata from Brooklyn?
Hi. I'm happy to be on your show. I listen to you every day at work. I just had to call because I'm saying that, you know, women are saying that they want to start, you know, running for office because of what happened in the election of this year. I think I was a Democrat. I changed to Republican. I hadn't voted in years because I was so ashamed of the way our government is running our country. I think Mr. Trump is going to be doing a great job, and they should give him a chance. I'm embarrassed as a woman to see all these women out there going out there and making a fool of themselves when they should just grow up.
Well, in other words, you don't think that women should get involved in political activism?
No.
Or just not just the women who you don't agree with?
No. They should get involved in the public office because they want to do something good for this country, not because of what happened in our last election. There was nothing wrong with what happened in our last election. I says Hillary Clinton, it was a very corrupt person. She should have been out of the office. This guy, Mr. Trump, President Trump, decided to run because he wants to make this country back to the way it used to be, have some pride in our country, which we don't have any longer. Women are running now because of the last election. I think it's childish.
Okay,
you
well,
know, and the more education you have in this country, the dumber a person can be. I don't understand. I really don't get the way women are acting so childish in this way. And there are women that voted for Mr. Trump, for President Trump, and I voted for him, and I'm not ashamed of it.
Quite a number of women actually voted for Donald Trump. And when I think the statistics indicate that white women majority of them voted for Donald Trump. What are you hearing about this, Andrea? Obviously, since you run a bipartisan, not you, Andrea. I'm sorry, Debbie. You run a bipartisan organization. Are you hearing women from both parties being enthusiastic about getting involved?
I think that the increase that we're seeing is largely coming on the Democratic side, although we don't really ask the women about their party affiliation when they're signing up. But we want to see more women in both parties. There, Democratic women make up about a third of all the Democratic women, of all the Democratic members of Congress. Republican women only make up about 9% of all the Republican members of Congress. So there is a lot of catching up that needs to be done on the Republican side. But I think it would be really a miss, a real mistake to think about the women who are running as being childish. I think these women who are wanting to run and wanting to be more engaged in politics, learn more about how the system works and how they can have a voice, are there because they also want this country to be great and strong. They may disagree with the way this administration is going about it or the way your last caller feels things should be going. But I think people who run for office in large part run because they want to do good. They want to see things better. May disagree with their position on issues, but that's why they're running. So I think the women that we're seeing across the country who are more and more engaged, more and more involved, looking for ways to have a voice, are doing so because they care deeply about this country and they want to make sure they have a voice in shaping its future.
And sometimes they break with their parties, as we saw on the Betsy DeVos vote, where the two women in the Senate voted against confirmation. Although they voted, you wanted to jump in here, Andrea.
Yeah, women are highly effective legislators, and on average, congresswomen sponsor, co-sponsor, and pass more legislation than their male counterparts. So this is really about getting our government functioning again at every level, and we need the best and the brightest in this country to be serving in office. We have 520,000 political offices in this country, and so leaving women out of these important positions is really not good for our country. And I just want to say that in 2016, before this election, or on Election Day, Emerge had 330 women running for office in the last cycle. And on Election Day, we had 213 women on the ballot, and 150 of them won. So these were women before this election who were excited about running and serving their communities. And so 70% of those women won in red states, blue states, and purple states. And so the issue is, it's not enough just to have women who are interested. We have to take them from being interested to filing papers to successfully running.
So is that the kind of training that you offer women interested in getting involved in politics, teaching them how to fundraise, canvass for a political campaign, file the papers, and all of those other things?
That's correct, Leonard, because as Kate said, being interested, somebody who is outside of that political realm doesn't know how to necessarily even enter the political arena, much less do all of the things, build a field campaign, you know, do public speaking. So that's what we train our women to do, and that's why we had a 70% success rate in November. And it's really critical that we provide women with the tools to be successful. And that's why we need to make this different from 1992 in the Year of the Woman, where we did see an increase, but then we flatlined, particularly at the state legislative level. If we want to see this increase and really turn it into tangible results with women running in 2017, 2018, and in the future, we need to give these women the tools they need to run and be successful.
I just want to say that I think Andrew is making a really good point, because we have been at this kind of flatlining for women serving, particularly at the state legislative level, for almost 20 years now. And it's the the training is critically important because we know that women don't necessarily feel that they are as qualified to run for office, and they may be more reluctant. But we also know there are lots of women out there who want to run, and there's a whole other component to this that's about the political parties and their commitment to recruiting more women to run, because one of the things that we know from some of that research that was done by American University is that women are less likely to get recruited to run for office than their male counterparts. And we know from our research that women are more likely to run if they do get recruited. So that recruitment piece is critically important. So it's wonderful that we're doing our program, Emerge is doing their program, there are programs for Republican women, there are other nonpartisan programs out there doing the kind of training that needs to be done so that women have the tools. But we also need to look to those gatekeepers that are out there that may be not opening the doors in the same way to women who want to run for office.
Kelly Dittmar, professor at the Center for American Women in Politics, recently wrote about the gendered nature of campaign institutions. What did you mean by that?
Well, it's that politics in general is gendered space. It's very male. And the way our politics work is geared more towards men. The assumptions are very male. And so it is on that terrain that women are taking steps into. And that's why it is not completely a level playing field for women coming into American politics. And that's why it's so important that there are programs like the training program, like Emerge, like our Ready to Run program. But because of that gendered terrain, we also need to look to those party leaders who are largely male and make sure that they are reaching out and looking to people that are not the usual suspects to be candidates for office.
Women in the past who went into Congress were often the widows of men who had died in those offices. It's hard to run against an incumbent, male or female. So aren't women also just who have decided to run for an office running against something that can just as easily stymie a man?
Well, certainly it's easier to run an open seat. We certainly have found that. But when women step up to the plate and, again, are prepared because they've been trained, they know how to do it, they can be just as competitive as men. And in our Emerge program, we take women through a six-month training program together with other women. And this is really a crucial factor as well when you talk about the gendered nature of politics. When you have other women learning how to run together, you form this bond. And then you have women to rely on when you're going through these tough races, maybe against an incumbent. Maybe it's not an open seat. And we had an incredible woman, Attica Scott. She ran in Kentucky for the state legislature. She beat a 32-year incumbent Democrat to win in the primary, making her the first African-American to serve in the Kentucky state legislature in almost 20 years. How did she do that? Because, number one, she's a great candidate. Because you cannot win races in this country or anywhere if you don't start with a good candidate. She ran a great campaign and had a fantastic message, and she ran and won in Kentucky. So women can do this. We can run against incumbents in red states, in blue states, in purple states. We just need to be smart. We need to have good candidates, well-trained, have a network to back them up, and get more women running all over this country.
I'm speaking
Absolutely.
With Andrea Dew-Steele, president and founder of Emerge America, and Debbie Walsh, director of the Center for American Women and Politics at the Eagleton Institute of Politics at Rutgers University. This is WMYC, WNYC.org. Debbie, I'm sorry I stepped on you, but
That's
I had to do
okay.
that break.
I didn't want to step on you. I just wanted to echo what Andrea is saying, because what we know is that when women run, they win at about the same rate as men do in comparable races. We just need to see more women running, and we need to see the parties and those gatekeepers out there reaching out to women and recruiting them to run for office.
Doesn't the double standard affect candidates from both political parties? In 2016, Michelle Bachmann, a very conservative former congresswoman, told the Huffington Post, "I really do have great empathy for what Mrs. Clinton is going through, because the hill that she has to climb on, appearance, is just a different hill than men have to climb. I'm not whining about it. It's just reality. And does that reality deter women from getting involved if they have to think about being looked at for their clothing, for their hairstyle, for whether their voice is deep enough?
Yeah, and those double standards do exist out there, and they do exist for women in both parties, Democrats and Republicans. Certainly when you saw Michelle Bachmann running, there were articles written about her eyelashes, about her shoes. You may have disagreed with Michelle Bachmann on a whole range of issues, but disagree with her on the issues. Don't disagree with her on the basis of her looks. And this is a challenge, I think, that women face, but it is not an insurmountable challenge. And it would be nice if in 2017 we still didn't have stories about the appearance of women but not about men, but we do.
But certainly I want to add that what we tell our women who apply for the program is that when you're running for school board and city council and water board and a lot of other races, DA, you're not going to experience the same kind of attacks that Michelle Bachmann or Hillary Clinton do. It just does not happen at that level. And we have to make sure that we don't paint the picture of running for office as being, you know, so tough. You know, most women do not have to experience that level of scrutiny. And particularly, you know, the women who, again, are well-trained and figure out how to have a good message, a strong message, they can enter the arena, and it's not that bad. That's why I want to make sure anybody who's listening on this radio show doesn't feel like if you're going to run for office, you're going to experience the same kind of attacks.
Alessandra from Westchester, you're on the air.
Hi, Leonard, and thank you so much for having me on. And Debbie and Andrea, thank you so much for all of the work that you're doing. So I worked on the Hillary campaign, and I, previous to that, had several campaign trainings because I've always been very interested in running for office. And so I'm primarily calling just because, you know, for the women out there who are listening, I think that we need you now more than ever. And so to the woman who called in that said that, you know, women stepping up now are simply fools, I have to say that I vehemently disagree, because for many, many years, what we've seen is men wake up in the morning. There's this wonderful phrase. Men wake up in the morning, they put their feet on the floor, and they say, I think I'm going to run for office. And then a woman wakes up in the morning and says, oh, she puts her feet on the floor, and she says, you know, I think I want to run for office, but am I qualified? Can I do it? And so really there's this huge distinction between men and women where women just don't feel like they have the confidence, and that's why these trainings are so important. And so I think that the trainings are actually going to be working against acting like fools, which men actually in politics have been doing for many years. And so I think it's the complete opposite, actually. And I think we need women now more than ever. I, in fact, plan to run for office in New York. I think that the idea of incumbency is very challenging, but I think that, like, you know, if you step up to do it, you got to do it the right way. And if you're authentic and you have authentic leadership and you bring empathy and compassion and mindfulness into leadership, which I think women can do an amazing job of doing, which men just haven't simply done in the past, then we can be better leaders even, you know, than our than those who have come before us. And just
oops, I'm sorry. I turned you up. Maybe my lack of male empathy. I do want to get to one more caller, Erica. Hi, you're on the air. Make it quick, Erica. We're out of time.
Really quickly, my comment is I would love to run for office. I'm very afraid of how it would affect my income. I'm afraid to publicly take a stance in this political climate. As a sales professional, I'm afraid it would affect my income, and I'm not married. So that's a real concern.
And then there are other women who are married and who worry about how it's going to affect them as mothers of and just as the center of a family. Men often don't worry about those things.
And these are the kinds of questions and discussions we have in our Emerge training, because women have these kind of questions, and talking about it with other women who also might be in similar situations is one way to figure it out. And you might decide, well, maybe it's not right for me to run next year, but let me position myself and figure out how I can transition my career so that I can run. And the good news is that we have a group on the ground in New York who want to have an Emerge New York.
So New York is 21st in the country in terms of women's representation. So there's a long way to go in New York. And, you know, if anybody's listening and is interested, please contact us at emergeamerica.org. Let us know, because we want to be in your state, too. We need strong blue walls in this country, and New York can do better.
Okay, emergeamerica.org. What about getting in touch with you, Debbie Walsh?
They can reach us at cawp.rutgers.edu. They can register for our Ready to Run program. We do have folks who come as far away as New York and Pennsylvania and Delaware to participate in our program. Happy to have you. We have a particular area within our program called our Diversity Initiative for African-American women, Asian-American women, and Latinas. So we are eager to see more women and a diverse group of women in office at every level. We need them there. They make a difference, as Andrea was saying. They bring a different perspective to the making of public policy, and we can't afford to waste talent anymore in this country. We need women at the table.
And we should point out there are a couple of other organizations, Emily's List and Eleanor's Legacy, that are also working in this area. My great thanks to the two of you for being on our show, Debbie Walsh and Andrea Dew Steele. It's been a real pleasure.
Thanks for having
us, Leonard. Thank you, Leonard. And nice to be with you, Debbie.
Walt Disney Animation Studios has a long history of putting animals on the screen, from Mickey Mouse onward. But with their latest Zootopia, the animals have taken over in a new way, and no humans appear at all. The film has already won a Golden Globe for Best Animated Feature. It's been nominated for an Academy Award, and I'm excited to speak with the two men behind the vision, its directors, Byron Howard and Rich Moore, direct from Disney Studios. Welcome to our show.
Hi, Leonard.
Hey, Leonard.
Thanks for having us.
How did you decide to make a city designed by and for animals?
Well, you're right. I mean, Disney has this long history. I mean, the studio is almost 100 years old. And over the years, including sort of the icon of the studio, Mickey, right? We've had talking animals for a long time. And we pitched this idea 5 years ago, if you can believe it, to John Lasseter. And he got very excited about doing a talking animal movie. And he actually, this is a quote, he said, "I will fully support any film that features animals running around in little clothes." And so he was very,
gloves.
He was on board.
But without gloves, no, which has been a tradition with animals in the past.
Yeah, I don't think anyone has gloves.
That's true. One. You're the first to notice that there are no gloves in Zootopia. That's true. I haven't noticed.
That's what makes it new.
That's true. Another
thing that makes it new is that in a lot of the old animal animation, all the animals are around the same size. Mickey Mouse and Donald Duck are the mm-hmm. same size. But here, they are all pretty much the sizes that they would be in the real world. And you have created distinct neighborhoods like Tundra Town and Little Rodentia, all of the ethnic mm-hmm. neighborhoods that we find in most cities.
And that was a conscious decision to play exactly to scale of the animals. Like, I didn't realize until working on this movie how much kind of liberties are taken with these types of films. You know, like you say, that a duck and a mouse in those old Disney cartoons were about the same height, you know. So, but we really wanted to be true, you know, to the scale of each animal. And we wanted to be true to kind of the climates that they come from. So that's where the whole idea of these different kind of ecological zones, you know, in the city of Zootopia that accommodated each, you know, species of animals came from.
And the city is built for them. Even their cars are tailor-made.
Yes.
It's true. And well, just off of what Rich was saying there, and there's a lot of New York, honestly, in the DNA of this movie. We did look at world cities. We wanted the city to feel international, but one of the key ideas that we all talked about early on was these boroughs, and we did a lot of research trips to New York.
Not actual boroughs.
There are boroughs in the boroughs, but we've spent a lot of time in Brooklyn and in parts of Manhattan, where, you know, Chinatown and Little Italy kind of butt up against each other, and to see how different populations affect their environment and how those borders change and what that feels like. And so all of that is taken into account in Zootopia. So it didn't just feel like we were just doing the typical cartoony animal film.
Well, you mentioned Edgar Burroughs, but you weren't inspired by Tarzana in Los Angeles, were you?
Which is the home of Michael Giacchino.
That's true.
Who did the score for this movie. So, yeah, Tarzana was very, very influencing on this movie.
Yeah, it's got some rainforesty areas.
Did you do research on the animals themselves? How many different species of animals have you included?
We have 64 different species of animals in Zootopia. They're all mammals because we thought the predator-prey thing was clearest with mammals. And in the movie, I think there are probably 100,000 individuals on the screen. And we did more than
70 different species, I believe, of mammals.
And the fur is all different on each one.
And before I get to how you make fur look like fur in animation, this whole matter of predator and prey, they have to find a way to live together. But that is a major part of the plot.
It's true.
It is. And we through Judy's childhood, we described to the audience how they came to Predator and Prey, came to a point where they accepted each other back ages ago, you know, and decided to live together in harmony. And things have been good since then.
Mm-hmm. Judy, the audience, unless it's
Judy
seen
Hopps,
the movie, Judy Hopps is a bunny,
a bunny,
rookie officer.
Main character.
She's a rookie cop.
And it's a bunny who wants to become a police officer, which is not common. It's very uncommon in the city of Zootopia. Most of the police officers are big animals like rhinos and bears and elephants. So for Judy to want to do this is very, very kind of out of the box thinking.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Oh, yeah. Well, I was just going to say, it was the whole predator-prey thing is interesting because, you know, we did pair Judy, a rabbit, up with her natural enemy, a fox, and that came from research. And we also took a journey to Kenya in Africa with our team to do research onto animals. And during that trip, one of the key ideas of the movie came to light, which was, you know, we saw as we were camping near these watering holes where animals would come in to drink during the day. We would see zebra drinking right next to lions, and there was no funny business. No one was eating anyone. Everyone was cooperating because it was this common need. And we thought, well, that's interesting. There's these two groups, predator and prey, that have to find a way to coexist. And we thought, that's just like human beings. That's just like our own cities. And that's where this idea of talking about bias and discrimination came up very organically years ago before any of this nonsense with what's going on in the news is happening.
Judy has to fight the police force's bias as well because she's a small bunny, not expected to be able to take on larger animals. But you mentioned racism. Could you have predicted when this project first started just how timely this movie would turn out to be?
We did not think it would be as timely as it was. You know, when we were in production of the film, the incidents in Ferguson were starting to unfold, and various other places in the United States where we were seeing civil unrest. And it really made us, as filmmakers, kind of double down on presenting the story in the best way that we possibly could.
So did you change it?
Because unfortunately, the topics of bias and discrimination and racism, these are evergreen topics we're finding out, you know. And I am surprised that the world has kind of turned into the fear-mongering, you know, values that we have in the film. You know, we're seeing them in our own world, in our own country today. I like, though, that the film is coming out at this time because it offers up hope in the end, you know, that those forces of fear, you know, can be overcome. Mm-hmm. And it starts with the individual.
And when you say it offers a hope, what is your target audience?
Well, it's funny. Last week, you know, the film has been out for about a year, And last week we did a screening at the Santa Barbara Film Festival for, there are two screenings, 2,200 kids in each one. They're all fifth and sixth graders. These are probably 9 or 10 year olds. And as part of this event, they bust them in from 31 different schools. And they those kids watched the film and they created these posters where I was moved by what I saw in the poster because they took the ideas of the movie and they went further. And the wonderful thing was is that nothing they were putting up there was political particularly, but it was very socially aware. And just they have – there's an emotional core of goodness and empathy that I think adults could learn from. Looking at those kids and the message they take away from this movie and other things in their world, they're a great example of the hope that we hoped to kind of leave people with as they walked out of the theater.
And what's been the response when you've screened it abroad? Do foreign countries respond the same way that Americans do?
Well, we had the good fortune of being able to take this movie all over the world, Byron and I, and represent it and screen it for lots of different audiences overseas. And those audiences, they take away the same message that we do here in America. Maybe they see the forces of opposition being something different, you know, but the names of those opposition forces, you know, mm-hmm. change from country to country. But I think that when you're telling a story like this, using talking animals, you know, kind of puts it almost into a fable-like, you know, realm. I think Aesop knew this well mm-hmm. way back when in writing those classic fables, that a human being is able to kind of accept and digest a story, you know, about some of the more difficult aspects of life if it's being told through a main character mm-hmm. that is an animal or an inanimate object or someone that's very different from themselves. It's a paradox, but it works so well in kind of getting across these universal messages mm-hmm. that cut through gender, nationality,
so Rich,
religion.
I guess that directing episodes of The Simpsons wasn't really good training for this.
It was great. It was fantastic. I mean, on The Simpsons, I really cut my teeth on social satire, you know, that above anything else, you know, that's what I consider that show to be. It's kind of a celebration of the foibles of what makes us human, you know, and mm-hmm. what's fun and both noble about being human beings. So it was a different way of kind of telling those same, you know, anecdotes through animals, but just as powerful, I think.
Byron, your co-directors here, how did you split uh-huh. up the responsibilities?
Well, we try to be in the room as much as possible, always. I mean, you know, different directing pairs have different ways of working, but I think Rich and I tended to feel like the more we could be together, two brains in one room was the best. And honestly, I think it's generally true here at Disney, is like the best idea wins. So it's really not me or Rich or any one person who's like ruling this place and driving it. It's like we're a really cooperative team, because we all know what we want to get out of this movie. And, you know, one of the things I want to say really quick off what you guys were talking about is something that The Simpsons and this movie have in common is the use of humor to kind of elevate and to be able to talk on many different levels for many different ages of audience. Because we knew that kids would love the film, but we also wanted to create a film where parents and adults of all ages would be able to see something that they found humor. And that sloth sequence was a great example. That was one of the first things that really landed, and we went, wow, that's exactly what this world needs to be. It's got to be a parallel to our own where we could relate to it, but just a little fuzzier.
And then, of course, there's the casting. You have Jennifer Goodwin and Jason Bateman and voicing the parts. And also, speaking of typecasting, you got Shakira to play the Zootopia pop star Gazelle.
mm-hmm. And yeah, she kind of represents the soul of the city. Mm-hmm. And she was wonderful to work with. Mm-hmm. We recorded her song and her dialogue at her home in Barcelona. And she really, from the very first pitch of the movie, of the story, she kind of listened to Judy's, you know, kind of her backstory. And she said, you know what, I really identify
with
this character.
We have to end it here. Congratulations on the Golden Globe.
Thank you, Leonard. Thank you.
Thanks, Leonard.
Good luck on the Academy Award. Byron Howard and Rich Moore, their movie Zootopia. Thanks for listening to Leonard Lopate Weekend. We'll be back live on the radio on Monday at noon, and be sure to follow us on Twitter at Leonard Lopate or at facebook.com/LeonardLopateWNYC. Enjoy the rest of your weekend.